The title of the work is not Maxims of the Fathers, or Virtues of the Fathers, or Theologies of the Fathers. It is the Fathers, Avot. Because the purpose of these maxims is to give us a window into the lives of the fathers of rabbinic Judaism. The Mishnaic tractate, known as Avot, is the most beloved and most misunderstood book, not only in the corpus of the Mishnah, but in all of rabbinic literature from the destruction of the temple until today. It is beloved because it is the one tractate of the Mishnah with which every literate Jew is intimately familiar. For generations, one chapter of Avot was recited every week on the Shabbatot between Pesach and Shavuot, and for many Jews throughout the summer as well. And it therefore became known as Pirkei Avot, or chapters of Avot. With the translation of the Siddur of the Jewish prayer book, the text of Avot became accessible to all those sitting in synagogue, and it also became the one interesting text to read for those who were bored during prayer services. Thus, writing in 1955, the literature scholar Lionel Trilling mused that, quote, "My intimacy with Pirkei Avot comes from my having read it many times in boyhood. It is not the kind of book a boy is easily drawn to read," he reflected, "and I did not read it out of piety. On the contrary, for when I was supposed to be reading my prayers, very long and in the Hebrew language, which I never mastered, I spent the required time and made it seem that I was doing my duty by reading the English translation of the Pirkei Avot," end quote. Similarly, the anonymous Mosaic columnist Philologos, who certainly mastered Hebrew, nevertheless confessed that, quote, "I have found Pirkei Avot ideal for reading in the synagogue itself, preferably during the sermon. For sheer beauty of thought and expression, no modern rabbi comes near it," end quote. This is true, though it does hit a little close to home. Yet, the work's seeming accessibility is also what leads to its misinterpretation. And so before we begin examining the text of Avot in earnest, before we begin to study what Avot is, we must first understand what it is not. Avot, Avot, how have we misunderstood thee? Let me count the ways. We begin with the common translation given to Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. The only flaw with this translation is that it is wrong. Avot does not mean Ethics of the Fathers. It is a Hebrew word which means fathers, and it refers, of course, to the intellectual ancestors of rabbinic Judaism. The word ethics does not appear in the title, and the subject matter in Avot is at times about ethics, but at times about a variety of other subjects: Torah study, prayer, politics, the afterlife, and so much more. Indeed, the very assumption that Avot is a tractate primarily about ethics lends itself to the perpetuation of an anti-Semitic myth, which is that the vast body of the Talmud is uninterested in ethics, and that the subject was thus relegated to one minor work. Thus, Thomas Jefferson, in a letter to John Adams, expressing a view of Judaism which was not very positive, and citing an author that he had just read, informed Adams that, quote, "Ethics were so little studied among the Jews that in their whole compilation called the Talmud, there was only one treatise on moral subjects," end quote. And so, to refer to this tractate as Ethics of the Fathers sustains a calumny against the text itself and against the larger intellectual heritage of the Jewish people. Another misunderstanding, the premise of which can be found even in many learned commentaries on the work, is that each maxim in Avot is universally accepted by the rest of Jewish tradition. In fact, even within Avot, the maxims often disagree with one another, because the rabbis declaiming them disagreed with one another. Is learning the most important virtue, an end in itself? Or is learning merely a means to proper and righteous action? Do we obey the Torah primarily because it sustains the world, or because of the divine norm? Does personal reward from God exist in this life, or only in the next? Is Torah learning to be ideally joined with a trade, a means of livelihood? Or is this a concession against an ideal? Rabbis and Avot choose different answers to these questions, and at times disagree profoundly. And that is what makes the work interesting. Further, those who misunderstand the diversity and the debates in Avot also often make another mistake. And this brings us to our third misunderstanding, which is the assumption that Avot is nothing but a collection of sayings utterly unconnected to the individuals that are making them. Thus, Lionel Trilling has given us the following description of Avot, quote, Avot, fathers, was one of the tractates of the Mishnah, which is the traditional Jewish doctrine represented chiefly by rabbinical decisions. But Avot itself, the last of the tractates, writes Trilling, does not deal with decisions, nor is it what a common English rendering of the longer title, Ethics of the Fathers, would seem to imply. For it is not a system of ethics at all, but simply a collection of maxims and pensées, some of them very fine, writes Trilling, and some of them very dull, which praise the life of study and give advice on how to live it, end quote. This is Trilling, and it is difficult to count how many wrong statements can be found in these several sentences. Avot, and it is quite shocking that he does not know this, is not the last of the tractates of the Mishnah. It is right in the middle of the Mishnah. And, as we shall see, that placement is quite important. Further, Avot is not only about Torah study. Indeed, as we have noted and as we shall see, it addresses a variety of subjects. But most importantly, what is so often missed is that Avot is not simply a collection of maxims. The title of the work is not Maxims of the Fathers, or Virtues of the Fathers, or Theologies of the Fathers. It is the Fathers, Avot. Because the purpose of these maxims is to give us a window into the lives of the fathers of rabbinic Judaism. The sayings in Avot should rightly be seen as the tips of biographical and intellectual icebergs. Because if this particular saying that we may see in one Mishnah was something that that rabbi said often, if it was something that he not only once said, but as Avot puts it, hu haya omer, he would say it often, then that statement tells us something important about the life of this individual and the challenges that he faced. This is the premise behind the methodology that these lectures will employ. Over the next six lectures, we will make our way through the first two chapters of Avot, which are the most structured of the chapters. And we will show how often one Mishnah is linked to the next, and how the maxims reflect the historical and theological and social crises faced by these rabbis, and at times, the profoundly different reactions with which the rabbis responded. We will, in other words, utilize these Mishnayot, utilize these statements to chart the challenges of Jewish history from the Second Temple through the completion of the Mishnah several centuries later, and show thereby not only the sophistication of this work, but the historical lessons that lie therein. Most of our lectures will focus on one individual, Hillel, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, and even at times we will focus on one Mishnah. Our opening lecture, however, will give you a sense of our methodology as we survey the structure of the entire first chapter, which, as we shall see, not only brings to life the leaders of the past, but also offers us insight into the enduring ability of halachic Judaism to preserve and balance vitality and unity throughout the centuries. And so we begin with the first Mishnah in Avot, which recounts the transmission of the Torah. And even though words will often be pronounced in Sfaradit, I will often revert into the Ashkenazis of my youth as we read the Mishnah. And either one is a valid lifestyle choice. Moshe kibol Torah misinai u'misara li'Yoshua, v'Yoshua liskenim uskenim le'neviim, u'neviim misarua la'anshe Knesset HaGdolah. Which means, Moses received the Torah from Sinai, transmitted it to Joshua, Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets transmitted the Torah to the men of the great assembly. Now, when the Mishnah speaks of receiving the Torah and passing it on to the next generation, it refers, of course, both to the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, and the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, meaning the authorized means of interpreting the Torah. This Mishnah, what we have just read, is the foundation of rabbinic dogma and doctrine. If we obey the Torah, it is because it was given by God. And if rabbinic interpretation is normative, It is because the rabbis are the heirs of a transmission that has gone from generation to generation, from Moses to Joshua and so forth. And what has been transmitted is not only the text of the Pentateuch itself, but the means of interpreting and applying its verses, principles, and laws. For those familiar with baseball metaphors, this opening statement in Avot presents for us the tinkers to evers to chance of rabbinic Judaism. Young people are staring blankly at me, having no idea what that is. And while some of the older individuals here who know this reference may find the comparison between God's revelation to the Jewish people and baseball to be offensive and inappropriate, I should add that tinkers, evers, and chance played for the Chicago Cubs, whose exile and redemption is one of the great and most biblical stories of our age. Now, be that as it may, this opening statement in Avot is what traditional Jews believe. But the question is obvious. And it is most famously voiced by the medieval commentator on Avot, Ovadia of Bartanura. The tractate Avot is placed right in the middle of the Mishneah corpus, and right in the middle of one of the middle orders of the Mishnah, Nizikin. If the composer of the Mishnah wished to inform us of the provenance of the Mesorah, meaning of the origin of rabbinic authority, that it comes from Sinai, transmitted to Joshua, etc., and so forth, wouldn't it make more sense to begin the entire oral law, the entire Mishnah, with this statement? But no, up until this point, not a single tractate begins this way. The rabbis at this point have already discussed the laws of Shema and blessings and prayer and all the laws of agriculture and Sabbath and holiday and marriage and divorce and torts and judges and judgments. And all of a sudden, the rabbis seem to say, hey, maybe you've been wondering, this Torah we've been discussing for some 40-odd tractates, where does it come from? It is odd. Moreover, any reader of Avot in the original is already enough of an initiate to understand that the Torah was transmitted through the prophets to the rabbis. So what exactly is Avot informing us, and why is it beginning in this way? The answer, I would suggest, is that Avot's opening seeks not to present us with a history that we already know. Rather, it seeks to present us with a theologically striking fact, that a Torah divinely dictated by God to Moses, safeguarded and transmitted by prophets, has now been handed over to a generation in which revelation has suddenly ceased. And that is the men of the Great Assembly, what is called in Avot, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, because it was during the age of this assembly that prophecy ceased from Israel. While we know little of the identities of the individuals who were members of this Knesset HaGdolah, we do know that they were the creators of the central prayers of the Jewish liturgy. They designed how Jews to this day speak to God. And this invention, as it were, of Jewish liturgy, of prayer, can be understood as a response to God ceasing to explicitly speak to us. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, describing the men of the Great Assembly, put it this way. When the mysterious men of this wondrous assembly witnessed the bright summer day of the prophetic community, full of color and sound, turning to a bleak autumnal night of dreadful silence, unillumined by the vision of God or made homely by his voice, they refused to acquiesce in this cruel historical reality and would not let the ancient dialogue between God and men come to an end. For the men of the Great Assembly, he writes, knew that with the withdrawal of the colloquy from the field of consciousness of the Judaic community, the latter would lose the intimate companionship of God and consequently its covenantal status. In prayer, they found the salvation of the colloquy, which they insisted must go on forever. If God had stopped calling man, they urged, let man call God. End quote. This is the age of the men of the Great Assembly, where the leaders of Judaism must now address how to respond in a world where God has ceased to speak. And this is the drama of Avot's opening. Let us study it once more and pay close attention to one verb, misara, transmitted, and when this verse is deployed. While we are discussing a series of transmissions, Joshua to the elders, elders to the prophets, etc., the verb is explicitly enunciated only twice. Moshe kibel Torah misinai umisara liyoshua. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai and transmitted it to Joshua. And then Joshua to the elders. Here the verb is not enunciated. and the elders to the prophets, again, not enunciated. And then, Unaviyam Misaruha, the prophets transmitted it, here it is again, to the men of the great assembly. While we're describing a series of transmissions, it would have made more sense to either use the word in every clause or only at the beginning. Either Moses transmitted it to Joshua, and Joshua transmitted it to the elders, and the elders transmitted it to the prophets, and the prophets transmitted it to the men of the great assembly, or Moses transmitted the Torah to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly. But no, the verb transmitted is stated explicitly only twice, in the transfer of the Torah between Moses and Joshua, and then in conclusion between the prophets and the men of the great assembly. Why? It was my father who suggested, and I believe this to be a profound theological insight, that the word transmitted is utilized explicitly whenever the spiritual gap that is bridged by the transmission is especially large. Thus, Moses received the Torah from God at Sinai. Moses, who, as the Bible stresses, was unlike any other prophet before or after, who alone spoke to God face to face. To transmit this revelation to Joshua is to give authority of interpretation and application to someone whose relationship with God was fundamentally lesser than his own. However, when it came to the generational bond between Joshua and the elders, or the elders and the prophets, all these people lived during the biblical period, when, according to traditional Jewish understanding, Moses was long gone, but prophecy still existed. Their access to the divine remained. When, however, we speak of the Torah and its authorized modes of interpretation being transferred from the prophets to the men of the great assembly, here again the word transmitted is stressed, as if the gap between generations is as great as the one between Moses and whoever followed him. The age of the men of the great assembly was wholly different spiritually from what preceded it. And that is why, one more time, the word misaruha, transmitted, is re-emphasized. Just as the enormous spiritual gap between Moses and Joshua was bridged, so has the gap been overcome between the age of prophecy and the age in which God has ceased to speak to us. The verb is emphasized. Unaviya misaruha la'anche Knesset Hagdola. God had stopped speaking, but the transmission of the Torah continued. And even in a world devoid of prophecy, interpretation of the Torah must continue. That is the point being stressed by Avot. And thus, if the Mishnayot and Avot are not merely simple maxims, but reflect the lives of the sages and the unique times in which they lived, then the opening Mishnah bespeaks one of the greatest challenges of Jewish life. A moment when, to paraphrase Rabbi Soloveitchik, the mysterious men of this wondrous assembly witnessed the bright summer day of the prophetic community, full of color and sound, turning to a bleak autumnal night of dreadful silence, unillumined by the vision of God or made homely by His word. It is at this moment, in the period of the men of the great assembly, that rabbinic Judaism as we know it is born. The opening Mishnah in Avot is not merely a description of the chain by which Jewish tradition was passed down. It is a statement rightly understood of the audacious theological premise at the heart of Mishnaic law. For rabbinic Judaism, our goal is to interpret the Torah that was given to us by the divine, one which Judaism believes was not only given by God, but transmitted from Sinai till today by those authorized to interpret that very word of God. But at the same time, the actual revelational bond between us and the divine has gotten less and less. The rabbis face this squarely and declare that lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. The Torah is from our Father in heaven, but it is interpreted without the assistance of heaven. We must understand the meaning of this phrase, the Torah is not in heaven, because it is one of the most misused in both popular and academic interpretation and application. The phrase, the Torah is not in heaven, is often taken to mean that the rabbis are free to shape, interpret, and apply the written Torah as they see fit, and according to the demands of the times, and of shifting zeitgeists. Or, as was once famously put, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. Or as someone gave a Hebrew parallel to that phrase by playing on the Herzlian quote, Im tirtzu ein zo agada, if you will it is no dream, by saying, Im tirtzu ein zo halacha, if you will it is not the law. Now, if this is true, then rabbinic Judaism is a joke, a sophistic shaping of what we claim to be the will of God, but is actually the imposition of human will. There are those who propose this. We will not be proposing this. And indeed, our assumption is that to assert this would be to render Orthodox Judaism nothing other than a rabbinic power play unworthy of our reverence. For those we meet in Avot, the Torah and its principles are seen as eternal, divinely dictated, meant to be faithfully interpreted and applied. And indeed, the Torah is our strongest solace, even more so than prayer, for these rabbis in an age where God has stopped speaking to us. The scholar Travis Herford, in his 1945 edition of Avot, correctly states that for the rabbis, quote, the written text of the Pentateuch might be compared to the mouth of a well. The Torah was the water which was drawn from it. He who wished to draw the water must needs go to the well, but there was no limit to the water which was there for him to draw. The study of Torah means, therefore, much more than the study of the Pentateuch or even all of Scripture. It means the study of the revelation made through these documents, the divine teaching therein imparted, the divine thought therein disclosed, end quote. In this theology, the fact that human beings must use their own intellects to attempt to discover the will of God is actually a virtue, because it means that every generation can discover new insights that are lying there in potentia to be found. Thus, the Talmud audaciously describes Moses receiving the Torah and asking God why he puts crowns on top of the letters, why he's going out of his way to create letters that are, as we see them in the Torah today, beautiful works of art. Just send us an inter-office memo. Tell us what we need to do. Why so fancy? And God replies that in generations to come, a man will arise by the name of Akiva, who will interpret mountains of new insights from every single one of these crowns. Avot's theology is summed up by one of its last maxims. And this maxim actually has the unique distinction of being the only Talmudic quote to appear in a United States Supreme Court opinion, a dissent by Justice Antonin Scalia of blessed memory, who wrote, quote, a Talmudic maxim instructs with respect to the scripture, turn it over and turn it over, for all is therein. Writes Scalia, divinely inspired texts may contain the answers to all earthly questions, but the due process clause most assuredly does not, end quote. Strikingly, I would add, but not surprisingly, Justice Scalia is, I believe, the only Supreme Court justice to have cited the Talmud, while the Jewish members of the Supreme Court never have. And so, when it comes to the Torah, turn it over and turn it over, for all is in it. For the rabbis, both the answers to legal questions and to historical challenges can be found in the Word of God, which we have with us at all times in the text of the Torah, even when God has ceased to speak. But who are the rabbis finding these answers? On the one hand, they must be extraordinary human beings, worthy human beings. But they are also fallible human beings who can make mistakes. And it is no coincidence that the rabbis acknowledge their own fallibility by the placing of Avot in the larger corpus of the Mishnah, right next to another tractate called Horayot, a tractate which addresses what one does when the Sanhedrin commits legal error. Those two are joined in placement, either preceding Horayot or in some versions following Horayot, which means Avot is about the extraordinary individuals that make up Rabbinic Judaism, who are charged with interpreting the Torah in a revelationless age. We recognize their fallibility. Moreover, the rabbis understood that because each interpreter of the Torah is different, this means that at times they will have unique interpretations of particular laws, or even unique approaches to life. Justice Scalia himself loved to cite the Talmudic maxim that if a Sanhedrin pronounces a unanimous guilty verdict in a capital case, then the death penalty is not carried out, because if 71 Jews on a court all agree on something, then something is amiss. That's an actual law, by the way. That's not like a joke. That's a real law. The men of the Great Assembly received the Torah from the prophets, but an age in which prophecy is no more is an age in which rabbinic leaders must figure out on their own how to deal with the challenges that come their way, the daunting conundrums handed them by history. This is the challenge that they face. They will have, at times, different answers. But Avot begins by presenting us with that problem. And it is in response to that problem that the Mishnah gives us the statement ascribed to the men of the Great Assembly. Haim amru shlosha dvarim. They said three things, all three of which, rightly understood, are a response to their age. Havu mitunim badin. Be extremely cautious in judgment. After all, we can no longer ascertain the facts by appealing for information through a prophet to an omniscient God. So be extremely cautious. Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, establish many students. In the age of prophecy, only one or two prophets in each generation may be necessary. We do not need a cacophony of spiritual voices, for we are hearing directly from God. Now, however, only the limited minds of man provide us with elucidation of the divine will, and each mind will discover something that the other may have missed. And if one is in error, he may be enlightened by his colleague, and so establish many students. The fact of human difference, of differentiation, becomes a virtue. And finally, Asu Siag LaTorah, create safeguards for the Torah. This refers to a variety of rabbinic additional prohibitions that then begin to develop to ensure that the biblical laws are not violated. It is, for example, biblically forbidden to cook meat with milk. To ensure that meat is not cooked with milk, the rabbis end up forbidding even cooking chicken with milk. Why, all of a sudden, the increasing of rabbinic prohibitions? Asu siag la-Torah, make a safeguard for the law. Originally, it was prophets sent by God as the time required who scolded Israel when it strayed. Now, post-prophecy, ad hoc acts of leadership are not enough for the long haul. And it is not prophets, but normal human beings who must safeguard the future of Judaism, not through ad hoc advocacy, as the times require, but through permanent and rigid rules. The first Mishnah, then, is a description of a world in which revelation has ceased and the interpretation of the will of God has been placed entirely within the mind, with the minds of man. The Mishnah thus implicitly raises the question, in a world in which the voice of God is no longer heard, where our communication with the divine has been cut off, what is our incentive for observing the Torah, and what form of rabbinic leadership is appropriate for such a world? Let us see how that is answered in the Mishnayot that follow, which recount the generations of leadership that followed the men of the Great Assembly, beginning with two individuals, one of whom succeeded the other, one of whom was a disciple of the other, yet they have two very different messages and two very, very different names. Shimon HaTzadik Haya Mishiarei Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Shimon the Righteous was the last of the men of the Great Assembly. Hu Haya Omer, he would say, Al Shlosha Dvarim Ha'olam Omeid, the world stands on three things, Al HaTorah, Al Avodah, Al Gemilut, Chasadim. On Torah, on Avodah, this refers to the temple service, and on Gemilut Chasadim, loving kindness. Commenting on this Mishnah, the medieval sage Rabbeinu Yonah tells us that what this means is that God created the world because his creations would in the future find favor before him through doing these things. Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasadim. Meaning, at the close of the age of the Great Assembly, the end of prophecy notwithstanding, Shimon HaTzadik is informing us that as merit for righteous action, God still openly intervenes in the world. And what sustains the world, what allows it to flourish, is righteous action, Torah study, temple service, loving kindness. Now on its own, there seems nothing remarkable about this statement, or the man who said it. The interesting aspect emerges when we ponder the juxtaposition of this statement with the one that follows, and that is our next Mishnah. Antignos, ish socho, kibel mishimon hatzadik. Antignos of Socho received the Torah and its tradition from Shimon the Righteous. Hu haya omer, he would say, al tiyu kavadim hamshamshim et harav amanat lekabel pras, el avu kavadim hamshamshim et harav shelo amanat lekabel pras, vihi mora shamayim aleichem. Do not be like servants who serve their master on condition of receiving a reward. Rather, be like servants who serve their master, not on condition of receiving a reward. And let the fear of heaven be upon you. A not un-Jewish statement. What he is saying is, what he is giving us, is a maxim about obedience. The primary motivation in Judaism is a dutiful response to divine command. The statement, however, is surprising for several reasons. First, Antigonus' maxim seems to be in tension with that of his teacher. For Shimon, righteousness, even after the age of prophecy, is rewarded with divine favor. And indeed, the Talmud describes how throughout Shimon's own ministering in the temple, he was the high priest, God made his favor known through miracles. So that Shimon says, we do the mitzvot, and we receive divine favor. Antigonos says, don't think of divine favor when you do the mitzvot. Think only of the command. There is a tension there. But even more surprising than the statement of Antigonus is his name. Antigonus is not a Jewish name. It is a Greek name. And this is the only Greek name in all of Avot. The name is not only surprising, it makes the sentence sound very strange. It is supposed to have an incongruity that strikes the reader. Antigonus received the Torah from Shimon the Tzaddik. To the traditional reader who knows anything about Rabbinic Judaism, you're supposed to feel the textual tension. It's like someone saying, Herodotus received the Torah from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's meant to be strange. You're associating two names that are not supposed to fit together, like the Jackie Mason line about American Jews who adopt the most goyish names possible. And he said, I met a girl, her name was Crucifix Finkelstein. That's what this is. Antigonus, student of Shimon the Tzaddik. If, as is the common assumption, these maxims are unconnected to those who are uttering them, then we need pay no heed to this appellation, Antigonus. But that is not our methodology. Rather, the fact that a Greek name is introduced is meant to shock us, to startle us into paying attention, not only into what this man is about to say, but also to place what he is saying in historical context. The sages describe Alexander the Great's conquest of the Holy Land as occurring in the age of Shimon the Righteous, and indeed insist that it was divine favor in Shimon's merit that led Alexander to spare the temple and Jerusalem. Again, a reflection of Shimon's statement on three things the world stands: Torah, temple service, and loving kindness. But a world conquered by Alexander is a world in which Greek culture, in which Hellenism, is suddenly everywhere. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik put it this way. Antigonus, he wrote, was a disciple of Shimon the Just. However, times had changed. Until his generation, we did not find in Jewish literature any scholars, national leaders, or high priests bearing Greek names. Antigonus is the first scholar of note who was given an alien name. Apparently, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, the period in which he lived was one in which Hellenistic influences had become a strong social and cultural factor in Jewish life and thought. The march of Hellenism in the Near East, which, notwithstanding the collapse of Alexander's empire, continued to move at a very quick tempo and did not halt before the gates of the holy city. It made inroads into the Mesora, the traditional community. And so if Antigonus is emphasizing obedience, it is, we may suggest, in response to the Greek philosophical approach, which is all of a sudden omnipresent. For the Greeks, the purpose of the virtuous life is eudaimonia, happiness, well-being. This takes a variety of forms in Greece. Aristotle is not Epicurus. But none of the Greek thinkers have the notion of righteous action primarily out of obedience, response to a divine decree. And if Antigonus is responding to his world, he is giving us this statement in order to maintain a Hebrew approach in the face of the flood of Hellenism. As Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, commenting on this Mishnah, the eudaimonic approach is universal in Greek philosophy. The absolute imperative, the ought, the stress of duty consciousness, were completely unfamiliar to the Greek mentality. The Greek mind believed that practicing of the good engenders happiness and well-being on all levels, and hence one should commit himself to this sort of a performance, end quote. And so Antigonus is responding to this. He is reacting to this. His name is Greek, but his message is Hebraic. His name reflects the new impact of Greek culture, but his statement is actually a Hebraic response, and Hebraic response to that culture. Do mitzvot, obey the Torah, not because of happiness or eudaimonia primarily, but rather because of the command. For Shimon HaTzadik, the Torah, the temple, loving kindness, these are the means by which we find favor in the eyes of God. For Antigonus, Shimon's successor, we observe Judaism without thought of effect, with thought only of obedience. Two different worldviews thus emerge, from a master and from a student, from Shimon and Antigonus, in the post-prophetic age. These two approaches are not utterly irreconcilable, but the emphases are different, and the maxims reflect unique individuals, unique times, unique perspectives. Having seen the tension between Shimon's Mishnah and Antigonus's, let us proceed to the next Mishnah. to the next generation, that which follows Antigonus. There we have the following phrase. Yosi ben Uezer ish Tzredav, Yosi ben Yochanan ish Yerushalayim kiblu mehem. Yosi ben Uezer and Yosi ben Yochanan received the Torah and the tradition mehem, from them. Again, the standard approach to the text is to focus primarily on the maxim that follows. But actually, the most interesting part of this Mishnah is what we have just read, because two textual features in this sentence are worth noting. First, if Antigonus received the Torah from Shimon, and then Yosi and Yosi follow Antigonus, then this Mishnah should begin by stating that the two Yosis receive the Torah mimenu, from him, or from Antigonus. But it does not say that. Rather, the words are, Yosi ben Uezer and Yosi ben Yochanan receive the Torah mehem, from them, which means not only Antigonus from the previous generation, but also from Antigonus' teacher, Shimon. Kiblu mehem means received from them, which, rightly understood, following the tension between the two preceding Mishnayot, should mean that the next generation received both worldviews, both understandings. They combined the approach of both Shimon and Antigonus. Is the Torah obeyed because of God's interaction in the world or because of the divine command? The answer for most Jews, or just speaking for myself, is yes. We believe that God responds to the way we live, but we believe that God's command is worthy of obedience, notwithstanding the reward. Elu va'elu divrei Elokim chayim, the Talmud says regarding rabbinic disagreement. These and these are both the words of the living God. The generation following Antigonus received from him, but also from Shimon, Antigonus' teacher. In reaction to rabbinic difference, the generation following this disagreement embraced both worldviews. And if two different worldviews emerge, their reaction was that that difference can actually be a plus. We can take from both. We can learn from both. Both are worthy of study and appreciation. So that's one textual detail that is striking. Yosi ben Uezer, ish Tzredav, Yosi ben Yochanan, ish Yerushalayim, kiblu mehem, they received from them. There's another textual detail of interest, and it follows from the first. In the previous Mishnayot, Shimon, an individual, is followed by Antigonus, another individual. But all of a sudden, two leaders side by side are presented as united leaders, successors, and receivers of the Torah. Yosi ben Uezer and Yosi ben Yochanan together lead, together receive, together teach, together rule. And this, I think, should be understood as a reaction to the recognition of human difference and disagreement. Perhaps given the obvious differentiation and approach of the two leaders that preceded their generation, it was assumed that the future of Judaism and of the community was best served with a duality in leadership. And a period of Jewish history now begins, known as the age of the Zugot, the pairs. First, the two Yosis. They are succeeded by Yoshua ben Prachya and Nitai Ha'ar-Bailey. And they are then succeeded by Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. Then Shemaiah and Avtalion. And then Hillel and Shammai. Two sages led in every generation for a number of generations. Not because they were the same, but rather because they were not the same. And because they did actually disagree. It is sometimes stated that debate only began following Hillel and Shammai. There were indeed a great deal of debates following Hillel and Shammai, and we will return to this. But debates existed before, and it was these individuals that disagreed with one another. This is revealed to us by a Mishnah elsewhere, in Tractate Chagigah, which describes the halachic question of whether one leans one's hands, whether one performs simicha, on the head of the Chagigah, the holiday sacrifice. And we are told in the Mishnah there. I'm quoting the Mishnah. Yosi ben Uezer says not to lean hands. Yosi ben Yochanan says to lean hands. Yoshua ben Prachya says not to lean hands. Nitei the Arbelite says to lean hands. Yehuda ben Tabai says not to lean. Shimon ben Shetach says to lean. Shemaiah says to lean. Avtalion says not to lean. Hillel and Menachem was a mysterious original colleague of Hillel that doesn't seem to have done much. Hillel and Menachem did not disagree. Menachem left. i.e., he was not that independent. He then left, and Shammai entered. Shammai says not to lean hands. Hillel says to lean hands. These disagreements match up perfectly to the people listed in Avot. In every generation, the two members of the pair disagreed with one another. It is recognition of human difference, of rabbinic difference, that is the foundation of the age of Zugot, the period of the peers. And it is no coincidence that the first generation to have received the Torah from a peer, Yehoshua ben Prachya and Nitai Harbeli, begin by bequeathing us a maxim that celebrates the joining of law, of legal authority, with comradeship. What does Yehoshua ben Prachya tell us? Aseh lecha rav, uknei lecha chaver. Find yourself a rabbi, a teacher, a master, a religious authority, but also acquire a colleague. This maxim summarizes the age of the Zugot. And this continues onward through Shammai and Avtalion and Hillel and Shammai. But then all of a sudden, everything changes. What is the next Mishnah following Hillel and Shammai? What words greet us after the maxims of that pair concludes? That is Mishnah 16. Rabban Gamliel Omer. Again, through our methodology, even before we turn to the maxim, just those three seemingly simple words, Rabban Gamliel Omer, tells us an extraordinary number of things. Rabban Gamliel says, what does this tell us? First, all of a sudden, we have one individual who is not paired with anyone. The period of Zugot is abruptly ended. Who is Rabban Gamliel? He is probably the grandson of Hillel, and all the rabbis that follow in this chapter and into the next, for the next several generations, are his descendants, Shimon, Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabbi Judah the prince, and so forth. The age of Zugot, the period of the peers, is over. A familial dynasty has emerged, along with an attendant appellation, which is introduced in this Mishnah. He is not just called Gamliel up until this point. Like celebrities today, the rabbis are just called by their name. Hillel, Shammai. All of a sudden we have a title. Rabban, not Rabbi, but Rabban Gamliel. Rabban is a term that means not my master, that's Rabbi, but our master. There is no Rabban Hillel or Rabban Shemaya or Rabban Yehoshua ben Prachya, but there will be a Rabban Gamliel and his son will be Rabban Shimon, etc. What has occurred? Note that for the first time, we are also not told that Rabban Gamliel received the Torah from Hillel and Shammai. We do not have that phrase. Up until this point, it says every generation received the Torah from the previous generation. Now we do not have that. Everybody see that? So what has occurred? What has happened? This reflects the fact that Hillel and Shammai's students do not merely debate, but create two entirely different schools, so that their worldviews now cannot each be transmitted together to the next generation. We have an explosion of disagreements. And in the face of this increased disagreement and the potential anarchy that may result, an individuated leadership emerges, that of the Nasi, the patriarch, who descends from Hillel and is called Rabban, our master, in recognition of his authority. We have a counter-reaction to the explosion of disagreement. And if you look at Rabban Gamliel's actual statement, it reflects the concerns of his age. Aseh lecha rav, make for yourself a teacher or a master. We've seen another statement that begins this way, but now what follows? V'histalek min hasafek, and thereby avoid all doubt. Here we have a deliberate paraphrase of the previous statement of Yehoshua ben Prachya. The opening is the same, but the meaning of the maxim is a direct countervoice. Yehoshua said, find a master and also a colleague. Rabban Gamliel ditches the colleague. Find a master, colleagues are not as necessary. Find a master and avoid thereby all doubt. V'yistalek min hasafek. Now, rather than finding a teacher and a colleague, you find a teacher and thereby a master, a ruler, and thereby avoid all doubt. Thus, a new age of Judaism begins, a reaction to what has gone before. And we are seeing the sweep of Jewish history spelled out in this chapter of Avot. First, there is human interpretation of the Torah that celebrates initially a dual leadership, which emphasizes the diverse interpretations that inevitably result. But then as disagreements increase, a more centralized authority, individuated authority is established, linked to one family in order to prevent religious and legal anarchy. The Mishnayot from the beginning until the post-Hillelian period then, the Mishnayot of the first chapter of the tractate called The Fathers, this chapter is actually much more than a series of sayings. It embodies a celebration of difference, and then it marks a move towards centralized authority. Understood this way, a careful study of the opening chapter of Avot, a work that is often taken to be a series of unrelated maxims, is actually so much more. It recounts the development of Judaism, and it stands, this chapter, as an embodiment of the secret of the vitality and unity within the development of Jewish law from the Second Temple until today. On the one hand, Talmudic Judaism, Rabbinic Judaism, Halachic Judaism delights in disagreement. It sees human difference as a virtue because the arguments over Torah allow for new insights to emerge, and the lack of revelation means that there is a role for future generations to explain the difficulties of the past. This was most beautifully captured in Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's description of listening as a child to his father's lectures regarding the disagreements of Maimonides and his medieval interlocutor, Avram ibn Daud, or Ravad, as he was known. Writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, "In my young and impressionable mind, there developed a dual impression. First, that the Rambam, that's Maimonides, was being attacked by enemies who wanted to hurt him. That's his rabbinic critics, especially the Ravid. And second, that the Rambam's only defender," said Rabbi Soloveitchik, "was my father. I felt strongly that without my father, who knows what would happen to the Rambam. It was as if the Rambam himself were with us in the room, listening to my father's words." And when the shir was over, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, "The Rambam was comforted and smiled because his opinion, originally difficult, had been defended and explained. I too was delighted. I would jump from my bed and run to my mother and cry out the good news. Mother, the Rambam won. He beat the Ravid. Father helped him. Look how wonderful my father is." But once in a great while, he writes, "My father did not succeed. And despite all his efforts, the enemies of the Rambam defeated him." Meaning the Rambam's difficult opinion could not be explained. "Although my father mustered all his strength, he could not save the Rambam from his detractors. Salvation did not come for the Rambam. My father would raise his head and sadly state, 'There is no answer. No one is capable of resolving these questions.' The shiur ended with no explanations. A sense of despair descended upon all of us. I cried. Even the eyes of the Rambam glistened with teardrops. With a broken heart, I would walk slowly to my mother and cry out to her, 'Mother, father cannot answer the Rambam. What will we do?' And my mother would tell me, 'Don't worry. Father will find an answer to the Rambam. If he does not succeed, then when you grow up, perhaps you will find an answer to the Rambam.'" That's the story. So here, differing views provide a platform for study, and hope, expectation, excitement is found in the belief that fallible human beings cannot find all the answers or interpretations in one generation, but therefore there is something for us in the next generation to accomplish. At the same time, the very term Rabbi Soloveitchik made famous, halachic man, bespeaks a personality that lives by law, and in law debates must ultimately be decided. Both sides cherished, but only one ultimately becomes halacha. Thus, Judaism both celebrates debate, but ultimately codifies as well. This is what we see in the opening chapter of Avot, and this is what we see throughout Jewish history. The ending of the Zugot, the rise of the patriarch, a Nasi, and a familial dynasty, which becomes the central authority in Judaism for the next several generations, bespeaks this other trend in Judaism, that every so often, traditional Jewish communities unite, declare certain approaches normative, and other approaches less so, equally worthy of study, but not practically law. From Hillel onward, debates increase in Israel, extraordinary debates, and entire schools of thought and law are created and divided. But at the same time, a familial dynasty from Hillel is established, which will reach its most powerful point in Rabbi Judah the Prince, who will assemble and compose the Mishnah, in which debates are decided once and for all, the first true written codification of Judaism. Then, interpretations of the Mishnah itself will begin, and debates increase once more. Rav and Shmuel, Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish, Rabba and Rav Yosef, Abaya and Rava, Ravina and Rav Ashi, two entire Talmuds, whose very vitality is founded on debate, the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. But then the Babylonian Talmud itself is ultimately adopted as normative, and most of its debates are halachically resolved. And then different approaches to the Talmud begin, and we see the development of Ashkenaz and Sfarad, each with their own debates within their rabbis, Each community's debates are ultimately resolved and codified in the Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century. But the diversity in custom and methodology between Ashkenaz and Sfarad continued. Now in Israel today, with the communities united living together, marrying each other as it should be, we may well reach a generation very soon where these differences no longer exist either, and where having separate Sephardic and Ashkenazic chief rabbis will seem nonsensical, and another unification will take place. The first chapter of Avot, then, stands as nothing less than both one chapter in Jewish history, but also an embodiment of all of Jewish theology and law from the end of prophecy until today. In 1829, the Prague scholar and publisher, an Orthodox rabbi by the name of Moses Landau, published a prayer book with facing Hebrew and German texts with the subtitle, Die Alten Gebete der Hebräer nebst Pirkei Abot oder Die Ethik der Alten Rabbinen, The Ancient Prayers of the Hebrews, including Pirkei Avot, or the Ethics of the Ancient Rabbis. This was the first time that the tractate was called Ethics of the Fathers. And as the writer of Philologos notes, in describing Pirkei Avot in this manner, Landau may have wished to counter the contention of the new movement of Reform Judaism that Orthodox tradition did not sufficiently stress ethical behavior in daily life. That the phrase was his own invention, he writes, can be deduced from a reference in the prayer book's preface to, quote, Die Pirkei Avot, die man eine Ethik die alte Rabbiner nennen kann, meaning Pirkei Avot, which can be called an ethics of the ancient rabbis. He wouldn't have put it this way if someone else had called it before him. Landau's motivation is understandable, but the translation was not only a mistake, it was a concession to a secularization of Judaism that began in modernity and continues in many circles until this day. The theologian Michael Wishegrad once starkly but correctly stated, quote, Ethics is the Judaism of the assimilated. Ethics is the Judaism of the assimilated. By which he means not that Judaism is unethical, but that secular Jews in the Enlightenment disavowed their past relationship with God for new and what they saw as pure adherence to the ethical. Judaism, of course, insists, contra this, that unmoored from theology, ethics becomes whatever the mind of man decides. Rightly understood, the much-beloved tractate known as Avot is exciting because it highlights the Jewish refusal to separate from the divine, even when the divine seems to recede. It embodies the insistence of the rabbis on building an entire world around God, His Word, His law, with each historical challenge inspiring debate, and then ultimately consensus and continuity. If we truly understand this, and develop a methodology worthy of this masterpiece, then we will understand that Avot is deserving not only of our love, but also of our respect, our study, and indeed, of our awe.